You put 50,000 cash money in the slot machine.
300 Quaker, probably in the slot machine.
They steal the door, they turn it to cash.
Okay, I'm on the northbound actors. Just riding the line.
What can be, Carl? What the hell can be done? I think we can set it up again.
If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Good evening, folks. Welcome back. This is going to be the second episode of a two-part episode about a guy that we once ran into, thought he was a big-time narcotics dealer, turned out he wasn't, and he was in the witness protection program. It was a pretty interesting turn of events for us. We thought we had a big-time guy.
Guy that was in the mob.
And a real guy, real mob guy, real mob dope dealer. Everybody was always looking for a real mob dope dealer to discredit the myth that the mob never deals in dope. And you know, they never did directly. They did loan a little money out to people who would then go invest it in a narcotics business, and they would make money indirectly like that. But as far as I could tell, none of the real deal made members in Kansas City ever put their hands on it during my career. Nobody ever caught him doing it. I'm here tonight in the Big Dumb Fun Show Studios, Studio 4 in a beautiful ice house in Midtown Kansas City, and with my good friend Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Aaron, why don't you tell folks a little bit about what you've been doing on the Big Dumb Fun Show and what you got coming up?
Well, I've been doing a drive time style trending talk independent unsigned music television program since 2004. And continue to do that with great independent artists. We just had the guys from Odd-O-Matic on, and they're the guys that provide the bumper bed music for Gangland Wire Crime Stories.
Oh, yeah, I came by and did a little bit for the Big Dumb Fun Show the other night, and they were here. Really nice guys. That's the first time I'd met them. Aaron knew them pretty well. Really nice guys. Turns out one of them's a lawyer.
Yep.
Who we have a mutual friend.
He's a defense attorney.
He's a criminal defense attorney. We're thinking about getting him on.
Yeah, I think we should talk to him and have him come in for a special episode where we talk about things, the law and crime, from the perspective of a defense attorney.
I think we should.
I think that would be a good episode.
I've done prosecution as a policeman. I've never done prosecution as a lawyer. I did do some defense work. When I was in law school, I worked for the public defender's office, and I did see, as a friend of mine from law school said, sometimes people aren't guilty, even though the police say they are, and I saw that myself, and so he probably will have some interesting stories we can talk about.
Well, I will definitely get in touch with him, and we will put that on the calendar. I got, by the time this comes out, it'll probably already be up. You can find the podcast episodes of the Big Dumb Fun Show at BigDumbFunShow.com or go to BigDumbFunShow.podbean.com. Listen to them, download them, subscribe. Doing a little crossover, interestingly enough, I received a book from an author who Gary and I did two episodes, I believe it is.
Yeah, we did two episodes.
Two episodes with author Bill Friedman. And Bill got in touch with me, started following the program and myself on Twitter, which you can do at Big Dumb Fun Show, and sent me one of his books, and I'm going to be talking with him about a couple chapters from All Against the Law. He's got some chapters there on Kansas City, and he was kind enough to send us a book and a letter, which I'm going to read here after we get done recording this episode of Gangland Wire Crime Stories.
Yeah, we talked about Frank Costello, who was a big-time gambler in the 30s, along with Meyer Lansky and people like that, and they had clubs, gambling clubs, casinos, illegal casinos all over the United States. And they were the first people that Nevada looked to help open their clubs, their legal gaming casinos, and keep them running and make them run profitably. So Las Vegas, you know, we ended up taking all the mob guys out when they caught them skimming in 1970s, but all through the 50s and 60s, the only reason Bill says that those clubs are able to run profitably because they had these experts in running a gambling casino out of the illegal clubs that were operated by the mob guys. So it's kind of it'd be an interesting show. He's an interesting guy. He knows more about that stuff than I know about my house.
So if you're a fan of Gangland Wire Crime Stories, the podcast, you definitely have to go back out and do the download or the digital streaming of Gangland Wire.
The movie.
The documentary.
Yes, you need to do that. All right, so...
All of this kind of comes back around, interestingly enough, to as you made the documentary...
Yes.
And you got the artwork and you assembled it together and you did the interviews and then you fly out to Vegas and you line up these people to interview, one of them being Gary Magnuson.
Yes. And you know, one story Gary told me, I'll tell you a little quick story. If you've seen the movie Casino, there's a scene in there where a airplane lands on a golf course and two guys in suits jump out and run off. And they intimate that was the FBI flying around. Well, that really happened. They were flying around. They were actually Lefty Rosenthal and Tony Spilotro both lived on this really, I think it's Las Vegas Country Club was the name of the golf course. And they lived on houses that backed up to the golf course, if you remember from the movie, because Tony would go out onto the golf course and go over to Lefty's house and come in the back door. And so... And Tony, we were talking to the agent about how difficult it was to follow these guys. And Lefty wasn't any trouble because he only went from his house to the casino, and he was FBI informant anyhow, so they didn't really need to follow him.
He wasn't trying to shake his tail.
He wasn't trying to shake his tail. But Tony Spilotro was trying to shake a tail all the time, was constantly looking out for surveillance. He swept his home all the time. He tried to sweep his telephones. He was extremely cautious. He would only go out and talk to people walking down the street and pulled his hand over his mouth. And that was all in the movie too. And they did. They tried to hire lip readers to watch him talk to see what he was saying. So they had an airplane that was just flying around and around waiting for Tony Spilotro waiting for Tony Spilotro to leave. And the airplane ran out of gas and did land on the golf course right behind Tony and Lefty's house. They showed in the movie that he had crashed into the lake, but it didn't. It just landed on the golf course, and then they had to go get some gas and shut down the golf course for a little bit and get some gas. And and I don't know exactly how they got it out of there, where they could. I don't think they were able to take off again. Actually, more I think about it, I said they got some gas. No, they had to haul it off. You could not have taken off from a golf course like that. Been way too dangerous. But that was true. And Gary was part of that operation that day.
He wasn't on the plane.
No. He was in the van,
He was in the van that went and got the guys that landed on the golf course that were flying around.
They had a van sitting down the street, and it's really hot in Las Vegas. So it's kind of a fun story. They went to NASA trying to develop some kind of a way to cool that van because they couldn't keep the motor running all day.
Yeah,
and lots of times it would sit there for 4 or 5 hours NASA couldn't come up with anything that would really work. So they just sit there. Whoever the agents were in the van would just strip down to their underwear and just sit there and sweat their ass off as long as they sat in front of, down the street from Tony Spilotro's house. And I think he knew they were there all along anyhow.
Well, especially because would they leave if they followed him? And you know, like the guy driving the van in his underwear.
Yeah, really. No, the van would just sit there.
There's actually five of them in there in their underwear.
Yeah. If he'd leave, then they could move the van out somewhere and then go in someplace and turn the air conditioner on actually in the van. And then when he came back, then they need to get the van in kind of close so they could sit and watch his house. So you have to have the eye so that you know when he's leaving. And he was impossible. Actually, they admitted he was impossible to follow. They couldn't really keep a surveillance on him, no matter how hard they tried.
Well, if he walked across the golf course to Lefty's house.
Yeah, I mean, that was one thing they do. They did another thing where they knew about minimization. They'd be on his phones. And so there's a thing called minimization when you're running a wiretap. And what that means is if there's conversation that is not criminal, that you can't say this is criminal conversation, you have to shut it clear off. And so they would put their wives on the phone to start talking, and they would talk, and you can turn it on after about 5 minutes. So they would put their wives on the phone, and then they knew the guys had to minimize. And so after a few minutes, and they jump on the phone and they talk for about 5 minutes, and they jump back off the phone and put their wives back on. So they could never, you know, they were really, really surveillance conscious. Thank God Tuffy DeLuna and Joe Agosto weren't that conscious of being tapped. They just talked like they were talking on, you know.
Like they were sitting in a private room.
Like they were sitting in a private room at the club with nobody around, which was tapped too. Plus, their lawyer's office was tapped too. I've been working on that chapter lately about how they planted the bug in the lawyer's office and how they figured out what room they're in. Is pretty inventive what those agents did.
Did you get any role from the wives?
No.
Any wiretap?
I've got one. I'm trying to decide how to use it. It's from Tony Ripe's wife talking to her brother, who was the underboss, Tuffy DeLuna. Tony Ripe Savella was the nephew of the boss, Nick Savella, and the son of his consigliere, or his kind of counselor, his brother, Carl Savella. And they had another relative, Tony Ripe Savella, and he had actually was in jail when all this started. So he didn't catch a case out of it. He wasn't really involved in any of the conversation because he's already in jail on something else. And he had come back out, and his wife had a problem, and his wife was the underboss, Tuffy DeLuna's sister. So I've got a kind of a long conversation about them, about something that she did. I'm trying to figure out how to work that in.
Because I think that would be kind of an interesting angle there with the wives.
Yeah, it is.
Being able to hear them.
Right. I've got one where it's at the penitentiary where Nick Savella is talking to, I think, Tony Ripe. They bug the visiting room in the penitentiary. And his wife is Catherine, was Nick's wife. And so she's serving up homemade food that she brought up the penitentiary. So he can hear him saying something to her, and you can hear the food going into his plate and scraping out of the dish onto his plate. And then pretty soon they're talking about this complicated plan to talk to somebody in Chicago and how they get that done. And he wants,
knowing that they're being bugged.
Right. And they didn't know they were bugged there, but they're figuring out how they could talk on the phone and get a message to somebody from Nick with somebody in Chicago. And so the message was going to be hand-delivered up there, and then they were supposed to go to a phone and call somebody back and at a different phone, and then they were supposed to send a letter to his house. But there's not supposed to be any phone calls from like Nick's house to this guy's house. And so he turns and he said to his wife, Catherine, you understand that? And she said, I understand. So she was somewhat involved, I would say. Anyhow, let's get on with our story tonight.
Yeah,
that's enough asides, I think. Don't
the
you?
The aside of, I was trying to bring it back around to Gary Magnuson and the
right.
And
you tried, and then I took off on another sidetrack.
Oh, yeah, you had another story from him landing on the or
on
people
the airport,
that he was
on
the golf course.
Golf course. Then we ended up with Nick Savella in prison, trying to send messages to Chicago again.
But we were talking about Joseph Sharpino.
Let me tell you this story about Joseph Sharpino, whose real name was Jacob Schlechter. He was in Milwaukee. He was a Milwaukee born and bred guy. You know, there's a lot of Germans up there in Milwaukee. And they also have an organized crime family, the Frank Ballesteri family, Frankie Ball, I'm not sure how you pronounce that, or Fancy Pants. Kind of he was nicknamed Fancy Pants by a lot of people.
But no one called that to his face.
He didn't like that to be called to his face, and they gave him that nickname because he was such a fancy dresser. So this lady named Sally Papilla came up from Chicago, and she opened a restaurant. She was a girlfriend of a kind of a mob captain, shall we say, in Chicago, a guy named Frank Busseri, whose brother was Fifi Busseri, who was even a higher-ranking mob guy in Chicago. And she opened this pretty nice restaurant called Sally's Steakhouse. And she was described, I read this one article about her, she was described as a raven-haired firecracker. And Frank Ballesteri said that she thought she was a queen bee of Milwaukee organized crime because she was really closely connected to the bigger mob outfit, the Chicago outfit. You know, the Chicago outfit is, they kind of like are the big brothers to Kansas City, Cleveland, and Milwaukee, the kind of the same relationship, although Kansas City was more of an equal and a lot closer to them because of some historical things with, between Nick Savella and Joey Iuppa and some of the Cherry Nose Joey and some of those guys from back in the 50s and 60s. When she opened this restaurant, she hired three local kind of mob associates and professional criminals to help run the place, and Chicago outfit guys would come into town and they'd eat there in fancy pants. I'm going to call him fancy pants all the way through. This is Frank Balistrieri. He didn't like that. He'd hear about these Chicago outfit guys coming to town and eating at this restaurant, but they never stopped by and, shall we say, pay their respects to him. They would never even acknowledge that he was around when they came to town. And that's kind of mob protocol is if you're a mob guy and you go to another mob city, you need to kind of check in with somebody. Whatever you're doing, you need to kind of check in with somebody and say, hey, I'm here. This is who I am. This is what I'm doing. He called her, here's what he called her, besides a thinking she's a queen bee of Milwaukee organized crime. He called her an outfit wannabe in a fucking skirt. That's what he called her, and he made sure that she knew that, and they hated each other. He didn't really have the chutzpah, he couldn't go do anything to her.
Do you know why she picked Milwaukee to move to and open a restaurant?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. I got a feeling there was something to it. There was something to it. There I think Chicago probably did that intentionally. I got a feeling.
But it's still, I mean, it's not Kansas City, but once again, here's another great location that probably still an address that exists for the Mob Tour app.
Yeah, it could be. It could be.
Sally's Steakhouse in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Could be. She hired a chef. She wanted to have a high-end restaurant. She hired a chef, and she paid his tuition at a good culinary school. I don't know what her connection was to him, but because he wasn't Italian, I noticed he wasn't from Chicago. I'll let you know his name here in a little bit. Actually, I don't. I have his name. It's an odd name. It's like a Middle Eastern name or something. I'm just going to call him the chef. It's too much trouble, too many people to keep track of. This is just the chef. But she had hired the chef. She paid his tuition to go to a good culinary school, which can be, you know, $4,000 or $5,000 back then, probably. This is in the 70s. And he didn't stay there very long, and he left to open his own restaurant, the Northridge Inn. And he had, I think he had an investor in that, and she was enraged. She was just livid. She went to him and she tried to collect $5,000 from him, said he owed her $5,000. He wouldn't pay her. She had somebody take his car, just took his car away from him as part payment. And he went to, actually what he did is he filed a lawsuit against her and she had to give it back. She was just nuts. And so she hired a local arsonist to burn it down. So this guy's name is in December, right after Christmas, 1974. This guy's name was Joseph Basile. He called a guy named Jacob Schlechter, our good friend Jacob Schlechter, who would end up in Kansas City as Joe Sharpino.
In the witness relocation
program. In the witness relocation program. And he told Schlechter, he said, go set that Northbrook Inn on fire tonight. And the guy did it. Schlechter did it, and he did it with his wife. Obviously, he's divorced when he gets down to Kansas City because he, you know, if you remember, the informant marries his next wife while he's in the hospital room, which we didn't wire up
his
the informant.
His girlfriend at the time.
His girlfriend at the time. So he's divorced his wife when he gets to Kansas City. But at that time,
he gets her to participate in the crime. In Milwaukee.
And then right after that, he goes to Basile's home and he wants to collect the money. Well, they promised him $1,000 to do this, and they only gave him $100. These are a bunch of chintzy mob people, and said, you know, we'll get you the other $900, but it's coming in from out of town, which also makes you think that somehow this Chicago connection has something to do with all this, but we never really figure that one out. Schlechter asked him, said, well, what's that? What was this fire all about? And then Basile says, you know, because the chef screwed over Sally and she was mad at him. 2 days, New Year's Eve, 2 days after the fire, Sally runs into the chef at another restaurant, walks up to him, and this was a brazen woman here. She takes a lighted match and just drops it in an ashtray in front of him and says, I told you this was going to happen. In early January, Schlechter starts going after Basile for the balance of the money due to him, and he wasn't getting it. And Basile said, you know, I'm getting pressure from Fancy Pants because he lost some jukeboxes in that Northbrook Inn fire, and you're the one that did it.
He was getting some pressure from Frank Bastelli.
Ballesteri. That's why it's easier to say Fancy Pants.
He was getting pressure from Frank Ballesteri because Frank had lost jukeboxes in the fire of the Northridge Inn.
That's what he tells Slechter, and that's why he can't get him any more money. It's just a way to put him off and say, you know, well, this mob guy's now Frank Fancy Pants was mad. But he was mad because they didn't ask his permission. So you have a mob guys, and mob people are going to do something like this in town. For example, the fire at the Hereford House. I don't think those guys did that on their own. I think they had to go to somebody
and say, "Is it all
right? Is it all right to do this?" And they said, "Yeah." And
they probably knew who to go to.
Yes.
And the guys they went to probably knew them.
Yes. And then they also had to kick back part of the money for doing it too. That's how it works in the mafia. Slechter, he's getting mad. He can't get his money.
Now, is Joseph Basile the boyfriend of the...
No, he was just another mob guy that was...
Just a mob associate?
Local mob associate
Milwaukee.
Who was Milwaukee, who was hanging out at her restaurant. He was kind of like working for her and kind of part of her little... She had this little crew who was doing stuff that she had given jobs at a restaurant. It was kind of like Chicago was setting up a little crew through her in Milwaukee. And not...
Asking permission.
And they do this kind of stuff all the time, and it doesn't really exactly make sense to the outsider. About a week after that, Slechter can't get his money, wants his money, and he is approached by another kind of a mob associate up there, a guy named Ania, Russell Ania, who is part of Sally Papilla's little cabal of mob associate guys. And he asked Slechter if he knows anything about the fire. And it turns out that it was just a test on Slechter, because Basile had sent this Ania to ask Slechter what he knew about the fire and to see if he could be trusted. And he said, no. He said, I don't know anything about that fire. Well, he passed the test. So about a few days after that, Ania approaches Slechter again and says, here, he said, we need you to do one more thing on this deal. He said, we want you to go break this guy's wrist because Sally wants him to never be able to cook again. And Nia said that there'd be another guy named Max would get in touch with him and tell him, you know, how he wanted to do the job. Well, there's another guy named Max Adonis who was an employee at Sally's restaurant, who was kind of another mob associate guy that was working for Sally. And so he gets hold of Slechter and he said, here's what I want you to do. He said, I want you to kidnap the guy and bring him into this particular garage so I can break his wrist personally. They called in a third guy, a guy named Herbert Holland. And so Slechter and this Max Adonis discuss a plan with Holland, and he agrees to do it. And they're supposed to pay him several thousand dollars to do this. Of course, he hadn't been paid anything but $100 so far. They're just jerking him, Slechter, around, and this Holland, too. They haven't given him any money up front. Slechter says, well, you know, what's the deal? Why do you want to do it? And said, well, he owes Sally $5,000. Well, he didn't really owe her $5,000.
That was the cost of the tuition
probably about the cost of the tuition for the culinary school. Exactly, Aaron, exactly. Adonis then gives his Slechter a slip of paper with the chef's address, the make of his car, and the license number. And pretty soon he finds a photo, and Adonis gives a photo of the chef, which was taken at Papilla's restaurant, and in which when it ended up getting put in evidence and had Papilla's handwriting on it.
I wonder if Papilla's restaurant is still there.
She lived and died in old age. So she lived several years after that, after she did a little time in jail.
Well, on the part of Slechter here, it seems like he's going pretty far out on a limb for what's only been $100.
He is.
And $900 if you're getting strung along.
Yes, but you got to understand, see, these are mob people that are asking him to do this. He was just happy to be connected up with these mob people because he, you know, he's a peckerwood, but all these guys, these professional criminals, they want to be connected to the mafia, the real deal mafia. They think they'll make their fortune and move up and, you know, get political protection and get good jobs and.
Well, it turned out he got witness protection.
Yeah, he got witness protection. Well, I guess he did all right. So this Holland and our boy Jacob Slechter and this Max Adonis, they start trying to locate the chef. They can't find him. And this Ania guy, he keeps coming back around to Slechter and saying, you know, what are you getting? When are you going to get this done? And they're pushing him all the time to get this done. And they're not very happy. And it turns out that they had an old address. And Adonis learns a new address on the chef. and a new place of employment and a new license plate number. So he gives this to Slechter and said, you got to do this right away. So Slechter and Holland, they get a couple of baseball bats and they get a couple of ski masks and they got the description of the guy, they've got his picture, and they've got the address and the license number all written on a piece of paper in their car. And they are headed over February the 9th in the, like about 4 o'clock in the morning, they're headed over to get him and kidnap him at his house and either break his wrist. I think by this time they'd given up on kidnapping him and bringing him to where Adonis can break his wrist, but they're going to go beat him up and break his wrist themselves. Well, there's some policemen who have heard about this threat, and they're on their way over, and they see these two guys driving around his house. I say they're on their way over to tell him that's the way it was written up. I think they were running a surveillance on him, actually. I think
they were just watching him anyway.
Because there was two detectives there at that time, and they see Slechter and Holland
in another car
driving around the house
like they're making the block.
Well, we find out later what's happened is Slechter's wife, remember the wife I was telling you about that helped him do the arson, some policeman had got a hold of her and put pressure on her, and so she was ratting them out all along during this time.
And they were just doing the surveillance, running surveillance
right
on
she hipped them that they were going to go do this, and so they were waiting on them. They get him pulled over. They find two baseball bats in the car, two ski masks, the chef's photo, and his address, his car description inside of Slechter's car, and there's Holland. They go ahead and arrest him for CCW, and they spend the night in jail because they haven't, you know, takes a while to put a case together like
CCW.
This.
CCW.
Carrying a concealed weapon. They arrest him for carrying a concealed weapon.
And the weapon
the bats. The bats, yeah. It would never hold up in court. It never would. That was just a way to hold him overnight.
They could have been laying in the back seat. But.
Right, right. I mean, anyway, you can't be arrested for carrying a baseball bat in your car.
But a baseball bat and a ski mask.
And a ski mask and a picture of a guy.
Somebody and an address.
And an address.
And you're right there at the address.
And you're at that address and you've got somebody willing to testify that that's what you're there for. Then you got something, but it's more going to be more like a conspiracy to commit murder or conspiracy to commit assault or something like that.
So they bust him, they arrest him for CCW.
Right. Put him in jail overnight, which is kind of the way it works. You arrest somebody for investigation, you can hold him for 20 hours and then get him out in the morning and talk to him. Well, the next morning, Slechter, he's had enough of this. He's in all this trouble and he hadn't got anything but $100. So he won't talk to the Milwaukee police. He knows enough that possibly the Milwaukee police could be infiltrated by the mafia. You know, they're always trying to infiltrate the police, and they get it done in most cities to a greater or lesser extent. They probably lesser here in Kansas City, but I know they were somewhat infiltrated into us. He wants to speak to an FBI agent. My friend Gary Magnuson is given the job. He goes over there and talks to him, and he agrees to become a witness against this Sally Papaya and Max Adonis and a guy named Enea, E-N-E-A, kind of an odd name. And they all end up doing time for the conspiracy to kill or injure the former chef. Slechter goes in the witness protection program and ends up in Kansas City and starts acting like he's a mobster and a leg breaker again and starts trying to sell a little weed.
Well, they must have set him up in some nature that, I mean, $100 isn't going to buy you a tow truck.
No.
So they give him a new name.
I gave him a new name.
Which was Joseph Sharpino.
Right. They gave him a new name.
They probably set him up with a place to live.
Get you a place to live. Right. Get you some seed money to get started.
Some kind of like, he's like, well, I can be a tow truck driver.
Yeah, because you got to understand you can't get credit. You don't have a credit history.
Yeah.
You leave all that behind. So they probably gave him enough money to buy that tow truck. Usually they try to set you up in a job.
You get a new social security number and everything?
Yes. You get everything brand new. It's just like, you know.
Like a new birth certificate.
New birth certificate, the whole nine yards. You got everything. So you're a complete legitimate person under this new name. See, a lot of people then, they want to.
Which is a good opportunity to continue committing crimes.
Yes. And many times they do. Like I told you about Sammy the Bull Gravano. He set up a whole big narcotics importation distribution program down in Arizona. And a lot more. We had one guy who was running a an illegal casino over here in Wyandotte County, Kansas. And he had actually gotten a couple of Wyandotte County deputy sheriffs to be his security and do his lookout the night the FBI busted it. But it was a full-fledged illegal casino. He was in the witness protection program. So, you know, did you ever see that? What was that movie with Steve Martin, My Blue Heaven? He's a relocated mob witness who is from a big city, of course, and then he's relocated to a small town somewhere. I mean, sticks out like a sore thumb. And they say that was really based on Henry Hill. Henry Hill was one of the more famous mob relocation people of ever. That's Ray Liotta in the in the story Goodfellas, the real guy Henry Hill. He went in a mob witness protection program, and they kept bringing him back out and flying around the country to testify against mobsters. He really hurt him big time. He knew a lot of stuff. He ended up coming back out of it in the end and writing his own book and had his own restaurant somewhere up in I want to say Omaha, Nebraska, I think. He died sometime in the last few years of kind of basically bad health and old age. You know, our own most famous relocated.
You said Sally Papaya. She lived to a ripe old age.
She did. She came back out of jail, and I don't know exactly what she did. She probably had another restaurant. There were some pictures in her and a little discussion about it. I didn't really look to see what it was.
Maybe
but
Frank
Ballesteri
helped her get it going.
No, he hated her. He never did like her. So maybe the Chicago mob guys, some of them helped her get it going again. Who knows? Maybe she had her own source of income or money. You never know. Sometimes you don't really look too. You make your initial case and you just go on. It's kind of what I did here. I found my initial story and I just kind of went on and didn't really get you. I'm not going to be able to wrap you up on Sally other than she did live old age and Milwaukee, and Ballesteri hated her till the day she died, and she died a natural death.
And Jacob Schlechter?
He disappeared after we tried to pop him for that marijuana sales. He disappeared after that.
Think he just went back and witnessed the relocation?
They relocated him. Yeah, when they get their security breached, if they either kick them out or they relocate them somewhere else. But my understanding
of the breach,
right?
Like in this case, where he's doing, if he actually was selling, you know, 50 kilos of pot, they might have.
He would have gone in jail. They wouldn't let us make a case on him then.
Because it was large enough that
right.
It was of substance, but, you know, two, three, you know, couple ounce buys, and he's just a.
Just a small time, two bit marijuana dealer.
Yeah, they got bigger fish.
Yeah, see, and we couldn't really get him to really commit that he promised he would get 50 pounds.
But he didn't really have it.
But he didn't seem like he really had it. If he had. He would have done it, and because the money was there, and I think the undercover was good enough. I think her story held. He might have just been suspicious, but you never know. You know, there's so many things that are left unknown in these deals that you just have to surmise what happened.
Well, largely in part because they took him back into the relocation, and he just literally just disappears.
Yeah, and see,
he gets a new ID.
He was an arsonist, but he wasn't really a mean leg breaker. He just had that kind of attitude.
And that's what your friend
Gary Magnuson said. He really wasn't that bad a guy. But he had the look. I mean, that's really all you really need is the look.
He wasn't that bad a guy, but he did buy a couple of baseball bats and some ski masks.
I think they were going to work over that chef pretty good. They probably were. He wanted to be a mob guy. I think he wanted to be one so bad that he was willing to do that or something about it.
I feel like he was actually running with some maid.
Right. Because that's what he was doing here. That's all he talked about, according to this informant, was, you know, how he was this mob leg breaker and he did this and he did that. And he was connected to this guy and he was connected to that guy, but he wasn't at all. He was just a liar is what he was.
Because if he was, he shouldn't be talking about it.
Exactly. The real guys don't ever talk about it. Whenever you hear somebody talking about it, they ain't the real deal. At least that's been my experience.
I think we've been over 30 here.
All right. Well, let's start winding this down.
Remember, ladies and gentlemen, if you enjoy the podcast, download. There's over 40 episodes from 2015.
There is.
That you can, if you make a donation, you put a hit out on our donate button. We'll send you a DVD copy of those audio files.
We would.
As long as you're in the United States.
As long as you're in the United States. Or I'll send you a copy of my movie. Or I'll even send you a t-shirt. I sent out a t-shirt the other day. But it wasn't for a donation. It was for something else. And now I can't. Oh, it was. I think a guy gave me a really good review. That's what it was. And he got hold of me. And I didn't really. I don't think I promised a T-shirt for a review, but. But
it was such a good review.
It was such a good review, and
contacted
he was
him,
he contacted me, and he's a loyal fan, and he had questions and input and everything. You know, I love having contact with you guys. So if you got any questions or you want to know anything more or suggestions, why email me? Email me through my website. It's info@ganglandwire.com. I've got a Gmail, ganglandwire@gmail.com. And tell your friends about it. Tell your friends to come in and subscribe to the website and get the latest. Every time I put a podcast up, you'll get an email at 4 o'clock in the morning that a new podcast is up.
You can download that right away.
You can get it right away. Be one of the first ones to get it.
And it's free.
And it's free. Yeah, you can't beat that. We are going to put up some premium episodes. I'm going to put up a free one or two, I think, just that... to try to help boost up my email list, and we'll probably put up some for $1.99 as a way to try to raise money. Because we have expenses, folks.
We've got some Freedom Information Act requests in.
Yeah, oh, I just got one. I forgot to tell you. I just got one in. It was not one that I really needed money on. It's kind of more of a minor character.
Don't tell them that.
Yeah, really? No. I mean, it's the $645 one. I got that worked out where it's a lot less. And I got a couple of, I got that one on Gene Maggio out there that I'm still waiting to hear about. This one, a guy named James Pardue. And this is a hell of a story, Aaron. I guess I'm going to put this story together. This guy, in his earlier career, he would go to a town, he would put a bomb in the parking lot of the local police station, and then he would go to the bank and rob it by the time the bomb went off. I mean, you can't write that. That's like something out of a movie. He was schizophrenic and paranoid and just crazy, but he had a brother that was doing these crimes with him. They ended up killing their father and stepmother. The brother, I won't tell y'all, it's like just gets convoluted after that. Our guy ends up in...
on top of setting off bombs in the
on top of that, killing some of their co-conspirators in these bank robberies. They go on this bank robbery spree across the United States from here to Connecticut, from Missouri to Connecticut. They were from Connecticut. He beats all these charges because he's a paranoid schizophrenic and goes to the hospital, the federal prison hospital, but then they kick him out of there. They say, well, he's okay now. He comes to Kansas City, and he embarks on a conspiracy that would have rattled this town to its very core, but something happened. So we will, I've got the old case file from the KCPD. I've got the Freedom of Information Act request back from the FBI, and it's pretty skimpy, but I've got all the info I think I can get. I'll start putting that story together. That will take me a while because it'll probably be a three-parter, but it's an interesting, entertaining story. You know, if you have a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol or any compulsive behavior, gambling maybe, make your first call to First Call, 816-361-5900, or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. If you're in Cleveland, go to the National Council on Alcohol and Drug Dependence, area code 216-226-2844. If you're in Chicago, they have a lot of resources at www.chicagorecovery.org.
And if you're in Kansas City, call or go online to firstcallkc.org, 816-361-5900. They've got a 24/7 crisis hotline. And download the Kansas City Mob Tour app if you're in Kansas City. Take your own personal tour of notorious and historic mob locations in Kansas City with the Kansas City Mob Tour app.
Say goodnight, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music.